It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
The path to reconciliation is one of listening, learning, and growing together. A path that recognises the central place of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in our past and in our future. It is in that spirit that we acknowledge the traditional owners of the land and pay tribute to elders past, present, and future. Welcome to Policy Forum Pod, the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy issues facing Australia and the world. Policy Forum Pod is produced by the Crawford School of Public Policy at the Australian National University. I'm Sharon Bessel. Today we bring you a very special conversation exploring politics, policy, and a healthy human future. You'll hear from the Right Honourable Helen Clark, former Prime Minister of New Zealand, and former administrator of UNDP, or the United Nations Development Programme. Joining her is Professor Sharon Friel, who is well known to our audience. And they're joined partway through the conversation by Professor Bernard Acosta, also from the Australian National University. The event was hosted by the ANU College of Health and Medicine and was recorded live here at the Australian National University. The conversation was facilitated by my Policy Forum Pod co-host, the wonderful Anna Greta Hunter, and I really hope you enjoy this incredible conversation as much as I did.
Thank you so much, Esperanza, for that wonderful welcome, and thank you everybody for being here today. What an extraordinary opportunity we have in front of us to explore the major issues of our time. Thank you to our new Vice-Chancellor, I think she's still the new Vice-Chancellor, Genevieve Bell, for those extraordinary words of welcome. And in particular, her acknowledgement of country really resonates with the way and the challenges that we face here in Australia, about how we imagine both the challenges today and into the future, the opportunities that were given to us and that have been presented, and the ways in which we can look forward. So I'd also like to start by acknowledging the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people on whose lands we are meeting today and the generosity with which that name Cambri has been given to this university. Today's conversation is going to cover a wide range of challenges, from the environmental, from climate change, biodiversity loss, water, food security, through to elements of our human behaviour, the pandemic, global conflict, issues like war, and through to the transformative technology of our time, the pitfalls and the advantages of technology like artificial intelligence, the destructive and the transformative. We will be looking toward these challenges and their impact that they have on humanity, on our health, our lives, our well-being, and our future. And it's pretty brave territory. It's complex, it's challenging, and it's the key conversation for our time. It's also one that we're recording today to put out through the Crawford School Public Policy podcast, Policy Forum Pod. I've been honoured to be the co-host of that podcast now for some years, alongside my illustrious colleague, Sharon Bessel, whose question and answer technique I'm channeling today. So I know you're here, Sharon. Thank you so much. This podcast will be released through the ANU platforms in the next few weeks, and so keep an eye out for it. I know that it's one that I'm coming back to. So what a privilege to host today's conversation between two great thinkers, people who have both helped me approach, understand, and engage with some of these key challenges of our time. Helen and Sharon, thank you so much for joining us today here at Cambri. I'd like to start today, there's so many different places that we could start, and it's sometimes hard to know where to start these conversations, and so maybe we'll start with the big question. As we look, as we consider our past, as we evaluate our present, and as we look toward the future, I wonder if I could ask you both what you see are the biggest challenges that are facing that goal of a healthy global human future. Helen, could I ask you to start?
Well, thank you, and thank you, Vice-Chancellor, for the welcome, and thank you, everyone, for coming, and kia ora to the Kiwis in the audience as well. So many entry points, as you say, for the conversation, partly because we live in this age of crisis. I can't think of anything like it in my lifetime, where so many different things are coming at us, and because they all impact on one way or another on our health and on the health of populations. So without putting these in any particular list of priority, obviously what happened with the pandemic is very much top of mind, and it stayed top of mind for me from the outset, not least with being asked to do the co-chairing of the panel that was requested by the World Health Assembly into how the pandemic response had been managed. And I think many here will be aware that there are very critical negotiations going on in Geneva right now as to whether there can be a pandemic accord coming out of all this, which might leave the world better equipped to face the next pandemic threat that emerges. The jury is out on whether there will be success this month or next or anything to ratify in May. So it's quite a tense time. Secondly, the climate and health issues are very top of mind, and a continent like Australia, you know this so well, you veer between these horrific and extreme events, the droughts that never seem to go away, the wildfires, the terrible flooding, and around the world our health systems are trying to work how to cope with these new pressures. We finally had acknowledgement at the climate change COP last year that there's the health day and health themes, and health is a huge aspect of the whole challenge. Coming up later this year at the UN General Assembly will be another high-level meeting on antimicrobial resistance. Not enough in the public discourse, but I think if, for example, we drew the analogy that people know what it means to have drug-resistant TB, think what it means not to have effective antibiotics, and where does that leave us when we desperately need them. Air pollution, another very significant global health challenge, with the vast majority of the world's population living in places below the level decreed safe by the World Health Organization. We come to issues of peace and war. Whether your society is at peace or war has an enormous impact on your health, and just think of the situation in Gaza today that people are facing, or Ukraine, or Sudan, or Somalia, or Afghanistan, or Myanmar. You know, we are in a time of horrific conflict. Then there's the pandemic that's never gone away, HIV, which we must not overlook, because there are certainly parts of the world where it's still very much on the march. Think of the inequalities, the structural inequalities, the discrimination, the issues of gender, the issues for Indigenous people, the issues for the most marginalised, the minorities. I put my hat on as chair of the Global Commission on Drug Policy for people who use drugs, who are very stigmatized and branded in mainstream society. Then think of those commercial determinants of health, the tobaccos, the alcohols, the sugar, the fat, the salt. I mean, you know, where do we stop? So we just have so many entry points for a discussion, because what is swirling around us with these big trends is impacting on our health.
It is an extraordinary list, and I think sets an extraordinary scene for the conversation today. And what I'm hoping we'll do is actually explore some of the common tensions that are across these areas. But Sharon Friel, what do you see are the greatest challenges for our time, for that goal of a global healthy society?
Well, maybe there's not many left in the list. That I don't want to be too despairing. I suppose if I was to pick two or three, and really just reflecting on life as I've known it since I was born, it seems remarkable to me that we continue as a society, as a global society, to tolerate the levels of inequality that we see sort of between countries and within countries. And that's all forms of inequality. You know, it's the economics. It's all forms of inequality. And I remember, like, you know, sort of growing up, I grew up in the East End of Glasgow. At that time, men would be expected to live to 60 if they were lucky. And it just always struck me as being just remarkable that that was okay. And so it seems to still be okay. So one is, what do we think of, what is the value in society, or how do we value society, strikes me as being an ongoing question for us. And then when you overlay so many of those issues that Helen has just remarked upon, the exacerbation of these inequalities and by these inequalities, and you know, particularly we do so much work around climate change, you know, the idea of, if we do nothing about climate change and if we do nothing about global inequalities, we are stuffed, is the technical term.
It's a good term for it, actually. Yep.
We're stuffed. And we can measure that by the distribution of well-being, the distribution of a whole load of those health outcomes that Helen was pointing towards. So to me, fundamentally, you know, what do we value as society, and really grappling with inequality and climate change seems, if we're thinking about a healthy human future.
So there's so much to talk about just from the opening comments, and I really hope we get to untangle a little bit of this web. I'm thinking about policy, politics, and how to achieve change. I'm really interested in the ideas of power that sit behind these drivers, particularly those structural drivers that you've described so well there, Sharon. Both of you have raised these complex webs of governance and power around the issues that face our time. So despite decades of commitments, both in government at a national level and then globally, for change on social, economic and security determinants of health, we haven't seen the progress that one would have hoped for. I'm wondering why we don't see progress. I wonder where the power lies. I wonder where the points of intersection are, and where we see the global landscape in terms of government. Is that where the power lies? The business industry and the economic structure, or is it with civil society and communities? And how do we address that balancing act? I will start with you, Helen. What are your thoughts about where power lies?
Well, states still have a lot of power.
That's good to hear.
Yeah. Big corporations have a lot of power. Civil society has a lot of voice and a lot of soft power. And it can be incredibly influential. I think we are in an age of much more polarized politics, and that makes it harder for policies to stick unless we make, you know, huge efforts to try and, you know, bring people together around, you know, shared interests, as it were. I often think, you know, globally, people will focus on shared values, but there aren't always shared values, but there are shared interests. What's happening to our planet, what about a pandemic? So we have to try and work on what we need to do together to really make some progress. I mean, what I think I would observe of my own country is that, you know, polarization on issues like climate has really held us back, and I suspect it's held Australia back as well. You tend to have periods where, you know, governments all go on climate action, and then the next crowd come and they slam the brakes on and let the farmers continue to get away with no action at all. Then someone has another go, then it lurches back. We're also starting to see this somewhat on some of the big public health issues like tobacco. In New Zealand, we've had really decades since the first Smoke-Free Environments Act, which I sponsored as Minister of Health in 1990, where we tightened the noose on tobacco, and suddenly we've hit a wall and we're coming back. And then on inequality, I think the whole, you know, experience of, quote, structural adjustment sort of hollowed societies out, middle-income groups, the more without a few with a great deal. And what I learned when I was at the UN Development Program was that the more unequal a society becomes, the harder it is to become anything about it, because those who capture power have less interest in actually addressing those issues. But that's where civil society becomes incredibly important. Be the conscience of the nation. You know, raise the issues, never give up, relentlessly campaign. And while it can seem like water dripping on a stone, over time, water dripping on a stone does make a dent.
That is such a great analogy, and I did want to just push you a little bit more on that, that question of we see extraordinary progress made and then we see it eroded and how quickly that progress is lost. Reflecting on your experience, both at a national level in New Zealand and globally, how do we see effective sticking of policy? How do we actually, what can we do to protect that undermining process, particularly for things that are important for the health of communities and for the planet?
Well, I think it's a vigilant public, isn't it? Because countries' politics do lurch. You know, what are we facing at the end of this year in the United States? Possibly the unthinkable. You know, look at the experience Brazil went through with President Bolsonaro, and these are not the only examples. And the only thing that kind of can be consistent, I think, is those very strong civil society voices about the right thing to do, whether it's battling on the wide range of inequity and inequality issues, the climate issues, the public health issues. So, you know, without an engaged public, democracy will die. I mean, one of the pressures I think we all face now is what is happening to our news media. You know, in New Zealand, we've just had an announcement in the last month that one of the two major free-to-air news services is closing down. And then that was followed the next week by announcements from the state telecaster that they were in effect dropping the major current affairs program and so on, and cutting back the news bulletins. So, you know, not everyone gets their, you know, their news off TikTok or whatever. You know, that people do look to moderated news that tries to give a balanced view, and we're in, you know, severe risk of losing that fourth estate perspective on what's happening in our society. So I think there's a lot to run flags up for and be vigilant about.
Sharon, I have loved over many years listening to you talk about governance. What are your thoughts on the politics, policy, and how to achieve change question?
Yeah, so I suppose, first of all, to me, it's a choice that gets made. You know, there's a very clear choice whether we do or we don't act on something. And that's a choice that's made. We'll act on this and we won't act on that. And I say that in a very Pollyanna kind of way. Of course, Helen, you live and breathe that, you know what that actually means. But I do think it's a choice. And so how do we help, how do we as the voters help our politicians make particular choices? But then I think, well, who's the we in what's the right choice? And I do that in inverted commas. And I hear among the public health community, the sort of the wide public health community, you know, we've all got our particular interests. You know, my issue is bigger than your issue. My issue is more important than your issue. And that's true. Everybody, they're all of these issues seem to matter. But it seems to me fundamentally that galvanizing of a coalition that basically gets over itself and says it's not about a particular minutia of an issue, it's what's the long-term public interest and how do we work collectively to that, recognizing that there will be things that can go early and things that have to come later. But what I am sick of seeing happening in that process is the easy wins, and the easy wins are always about pushing it onto individual responsibility. And that is just so inefficient. That has contributed to some of the widest inequalities. Our analysis tells us that. So that's one part of it. The second is, I think civil society has incredible power for the reasons that Helen has laid out. You know, the weapons of the structurally weak. The way we speak, way civil society frames things, so the discursive power it has cut through, the way of mobilising, using moral authority to help elevate an issue, I think all of the power should be with the politicians, but that at the same time shames some of the big corporates that frankly have so much power. If we think of, for climate change and health inequities, the fossil fuel industries that are on the phone day in, day out, they don't need to go through the public consultations. They literally pick up the phone to our politicians, and we see our politicians wearing their T-shirts in response. But we also see the power of big tech, and I wish Genevieve had mentioned in terms of her expertise around this. We know that The Voice, the referendum that took place in Australia, two companies in Colorado were generating fake news and disseminating these bots around Australia. So the importance of like big tech and these platforms, we have to absolutely, but they're political decisions. Whether we choose to do anything about them or not are political decisions. And so civil society and the public voting, helping the politicians make those political decisions, is absolutely vital. And that's where we've seen some of the most progressive change historically.
In my dark moments where I try to work out if there is the human future, it's that sort of political change which gives us hope. It's taking agency to people and making us part of the solution. And so if you leave today wondering about where the world is going, please hold on to this moment, I think, where we all have a role to play in politics. I'd actually like to unpack a particular policy agenda that I think would be interesting, particularly to hear the New Zealand perspective on, but I know, Sharon, your expertise in this area. And I'm interested in the economic system. Many of the challenges that we've discussed today come back, at least in part, to our neoliberal economic order that may be described as a consumptogenic focus. And of course, that neoliberal order has played a role, a significant role, in human development in the last few decades. It's also driven, I think, challenges to both human and planetary health and well-being, and particularly in that futures lens. We've watched from Australia, countries around the world explore the well-being economic framework and different approaches to their economics. And Sharon, I'd actually like to start with you. How important is it, do you think, for us to consider alternative economic structures? Do you think it might be needed?
Yeah, and I think there's a lovely question, isn't there, that our great colleague Catherine Trebeck often asks of economy in service of people in the planet, not the economy for the economy's sake. And I think it's that sight of what's the purpose of an economic system, whatever that economic system is, what's the purpose of it? And I think we've lost sight of that. Certainly in the Western world, we've lost sight of the purpose of that. Why do we think it's okay that, you know, the person at the end of the 7 o'clock news, for those of us who continue to watch the ABC 7 o'clock news actually in real time, but you know, the person who stands up and tells us all the financials, why is that remotely acceptable? Why is that how we measure our society, if that's an indication? So I'm all for an economic system, but an economic system that serves the wider public good is, to me, what it should be. But the reason it's not that, I think, is because it has been absolutely captured to serve the interests, particularly of the corporates. And so we've seen the financialization of the global economy. Stock market institutional investors love the financialisation of the system, the fact that the Australia has a domestic consumption economic growth model, and the reason we have that domestic consumption economic growth model is because we have created a really accessible credit market, and a credit market that is driving massive investment in housing and real estate. That's what's driving the Australian growth model. It's not just all about the exports. And that's a question of why do we think it's okay to have an economic system that creates excessive debt for households, potential debts for households, and houses that are the biggest on the planet with the biggest embodied greenhouse gas emissions, and that have contributed to massive inequalities within Australia. So yes, I think we need a different economic system that serves the purpose of the wider public interest.
They're such important, provocative questions to ask, the question why the system is as it is and what are the potential benefits and pitfalls. Helen, I'd be fascinated to hear your thoughts on economics, the role that it's played in where we find ourselves now, and I guess the opportunities that we see in changing parts of that system, both at a national level and then in the international sphere.
Well, I preface everything I say by saying I'm not an economist. But, markets create winners and losers. That's what they do. And you can't have that with society. You want everyone to be a winner. That's why I say the role of the state is still extremely important. Because markets have their place, but you can't actually apply them to health, in my opinion. You can't apply them entirely to housing, because in a market there will always be citizens who cannot afford to be housed in a market. You have to have that concept of the whole social wage, the living wage. All of these things require state intervention and policy, because otherwise we'll leave the free market to get on and create the losers. And then the losers, it's not only individual and family and community tragedies, but it's also extremely costly if people are unable to thrive. So I'm very strong on the state needing to have a strong and active role in ensuring that we don't create a floor below which and through which people crash. That's unacceptable to me. I mean, it's been expressed in many different ways over the years by people. Who was it who said, Jos Bahn, I can accept a market economy, I can't accept a market society. That's where I come from. You have to take all the rough edges off that system that creates losers in society.
The winner and loser model.
Well, I was just thinking there's a lovely conversation going on at the moment, Mariana Mazzucato's work around that mission economy, which is exactly that point of society, not economy, and the economy being worked with a very strong state in there, enabling and incentivizing markets to behave in ways that are good for society.
Just to tie it back to health for a second, does that impact on human health and well-being?
Yeah, sorry, I forgot about the health part. Yes, absolutely. So economic systems shape inequality within society, and then they shape what governments can do with public revenue. Inequality in society in and of itself is bad for our physical and mental health. That relative inequity gets into our heads, it gets under our skin, increases our risk of cardiovascular disease, as well as our risks of mental ill health. And then, of course, the generation of economic revenue allows governments to spend, and so spending on housing, education, healthcare, and that universal approach. So it affects our health in so many ways.
So we've started with the major challenges. We've talked about climate change and pandemics, and we've touched on the challenge of information in our contemporary era. And we've talked about some of the systemic and governance challenges that are interrelated with the magnification of some of these risks. I'm wondering about how we communicate this. in an age of uncertainty, in a time where imagining the future, I think, is more challenging than it has been. And I think about that particularly through the prism of climate change, where as the climate changes, what we see in front of us will be different to what we've experienced previously. How do we communicate? How do we talk to each other? Where are the important places for these conversations to take place? And how do we begin those conversations? Helen?
Well, one of the risks we face, of course, is that the populists capture the conversation and they come up with what look like simple solutions to very complex problems and often make them worse and then start destroying the institutions by which they got to power. That's a not uncommon path. So I think that we have to be demanding the public policy have a rationale that is based on evidence and values. You know, the value is that no one should fall, you know, through cracks to catastrophe, that everyone has to be enabled to thrive. Then what are the set of policies and conditions that will enable that to happen? Where's the evidence? I think universities have got rather a large role in this in bringing evidence and reason to the discourse and into the discussion. You know, the universities still in our societies have voice, have freedom to articulate and advocate, and shouldn't feel constrained. I mean, if I just sort of alluded to the previous question for a moment, I mean, poverty is incredibly bad for health. You know, if you're poor, you're likely to be less well nourished for a start. If you're old and poor, disabled and poor, sick and poor, you know, the loss of connection, the loss of ability to participate in society, all this incredibly bad, you know, for mental and for physical health. So, you know, do we want a society that leaves people like that behind, or do we want a society where we try and pull everyone with us together for a stake? And I think, you know, demanding the evidence of what works, what the facts are, what are the challenges we're facing. This is very important.
Absolutely. And tying that the relationship between the different policy areas together and particularly childhood poverty, the extraordinary impact on the health and wellbeing of Australian adults that could be achieved by addressing childhood poverty. We are going to come to our question and answer session just shortly, but before we move on there, I've got one last question for you, Helen. The model of international and national leadership that you've provided us with has been inspirational for so many of us. I'm wondering what your reflections are on leadership. What are the skills that are required to navigate this time?
Well, I think to be an effective leader, you have to care about what's happening to people, right? It's all about people. It's not, as Sharon said, about the economy as a goal in itself. The economy is a means to ensuring, you know, a good future for people. So for me, effective leadership is going to be empathetic leadership. It's going to be a capacity to communicate, a capacity to bring people with you about a vision of what a more inclusive, fairer, sustainable, resilient society could be. And, you know, the more, you know, I talk about these issues, those are the values against which I measure things. Is it going to help inclusion? Is it going to build resilience? Is it going to be sustainable? You know, will it do more good than harm? You know, and have leaders prepared to be very clear about this.
Well, and I was just thinking, Australia has a real opportunity to show that sort of leadership. I was just thinking, imagine if the COP 31, imagine if that was really hosted by the Pacific nations and Australia, New Zealand, supporting those colleagues to show the sorts of leadership that you're speaking about when it comes to COP, recognising climate change, inequality, health, all of these interconnected issues, with a strong, like, First Nations voice driving that forward. First Nations voice and First Nations knowledge systems embedded in that sort of leadership. It would be, I mean, I would love to see that. I would love to see you opening that COP. Yes.
That would be quite a thing. At this stage, I'd like to ask Bina Da Costa to come up onto the stage. And while she comes up to join our discussion, I will let you know who she is. Bina da Costa is a professor here at the Australian National University. She's in the Department of International Relations. She is also she's an Australian Research Council Future Fellow, and she's also a UN Special Procedure Mandate holder in the Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent. Between 2016 and 2018, she served as UNICEF's Senior Migration and Displacement Specialist and led research-led policy advocacy in the Horn of Africa, Jordan, Lebanon, and the European Union. Professor da Costa's work focuses on war and forced migration, on children and young people's protection in emergencies, conflict-related sexual violence and war crimes, human rights advocacy, and Indigenous rights. She's published 7 books, including Children and the Politics of Violence. Welcome, Bina. It's wonderful to have you join us. Now, Bina, I'd love to hear your thoughts on the conversation so far, but as an academic and a practitioner, you've been at the coalface, I think, of some of the impacts of the issues that we've discussed so far. I wonder if you might tell us a little bit about what you've seen in terms of the global impact of the challenges that we're facing, climate change, war, conflict, information. What are your thoughts so far?
Thank you very much, Arunagrata, for that question. I've been listening to Helen and Sharon, and also actually from front lines, in humanitarian front lines, thinking about some of those experiences and what they mean. We know, and drawing from both Helen and Sharon's insights, that the global has to connect with the national and local. So there's so much opportunity, so many different kinds of entry points we can use, but they may not always be at the same times. So one example that come to mind is on October 8, 2021, the Human Rights Council declared that right to a healthy environment is a human right. So this was important, and this was important because not only the Secretary General and the 15 UN agencies were involved in it, but we've had the business community, and we've had young activists there, the human rights defenders on the ground, actually actively talking about it. We have had 1,300 civil society organizations globally who also took it to different parts of the world. So it tells us that best practices can come when you have the buy-in from very micro level. And it doesn't happen easily. We know that human rights defenders, particularly environmental rights defenders, they work at great risk when we are talking about everyone's life, everyone's right to live in a healthy environment. There are different kinds of sort of interests and opportunities that clash with those kinds of rights. And here we see opportunities for young activists to come forward. So I think that's one thing I will talk about now. Thank you.
That's wonderful. And I wonder if you'd like to comment on the drivers that you see for the humanitarian work you've done across Africa and the Middle East has been extraordinary. What are the sorts of drivers you see of the conflict that leads to that tremendous amount of human suffering?
In terms of drivers, we also know that it can be pretty complex. You have obviously state actors, the political interests. You also have, if we only look at displacement, both conflict-induced displacement and also disaster displacement, we know that the drivers are when we have, there are sometimes different kinds of peace processes that are signed, there are peace agreements, but we see that communities feel that they're excluded. So here, we also have to think about, if I may change the question a little bit as an academic, that we need to unpack when we are talking about drivers, who is actually even framing those drivers? Who is talking when we are having peace negotiations? Who are the ones who are leading the conflicts and who are at the forefront of peace mediations? So here, thinking about women, women's rights defenders, and involving them is important, but also thinking that they might think of drivers very differently than, for example, ethnic group leaders would bring to the table. For them, there could be drivers about insecurity in households, insecurity, thinking about if they can't access water. At one level, we are thinking about strengthening institutions, education, schools, but who's going to make sure that the road to schools is safe? So we think about different ways of what drivers mean, actually, in terms of conflict zones. And if I may just take a little bit of time to draw on a feminist scholar, she has a wonderful Twitter handle, which is X now, Feminist Killjoy. So Sarah Ahmed actually talked about something very interesting before. She mentioned, I quote her, that if a world can be what we learn not to notice, then noticing becomes a form of political labor. So women, people who are in the margins, indigenous people, they notice, they perform different kinds of political labor for us. Understanding that, recognizing that, and using those at level of global is important. And that's how we also think about drivers, not only about data and evidence and quantitative research, but actually drawing on qualitative experiences, what they mean. Thank you.
Thank you. That balancing act of data and storytelling, I think, is key, and it's one of the extraordinary reasons why this panel is such a lot of fun. Helen, I wonder if you'd like to offer us any of the reflections from your time with the United Nations and the work that you've done there.
I remember when I first went to UNDP in 2009, we had a Bureau for Crisis Prevention and Response. And their speech notes used to say that the level of conflict, armed conflict, was the lowest it had been in a long time. They pretty soon had to change the notes because conflicts really began to spin out. And what we saw was that the nature of most of the conflicts that the world was experiencing were ones that the Security Council had never been designed to respond to. It was designed to stop another world war, right? Well, by and large, it has just. But it has not proved particularly adept with the conflicts with the non-state actors and so on. I mean, so, you know, a lot of the peacekeeping missions have gone in where there's been no peace to keep, places like Mali, where they've now been ejected in any case. That became the most deadly peacekeeping mission, so-called, in the world. What we also saw as the world, you know, polarized again was that different actors in conflicts, of course, had their protectors in the Security Council, and that plays out to this day. Even the war in Ukraine, clearly the protagonist is a veto-wielding Security Council member. The war in Gaza, there's protection, obviously, to one of the parties from another superpower. So the United Nations is really struggling now on its security mandate. I mean, the UN, founded as it was in 45, ended up with a charter that had it pursuing the peaceful resolution of disputes. It had a mandate for development, and it had a mandate for human rights. Well, the peace resolution arm is extremely difficult for all the preceding reasons. Development's on the back foot because of the syndemic of crises that we're experiencing. And human rights abuses and violations are a pretty dire story as well. So, you know, the time really is now for reality check. What do we want of our premier multilateral institution? Can it be saved, both from itself and from, you know, member states who undermine it? There is later this year at the high-level event at the General Assembly in September, a summit of the future, and there's negotiations on a pact of the future. Whether it's any good will depend on, you know, inputs now as to whether the institution can be updated, with the goodwill required to make it more relevant to addressing the problems of our times.
Now, that's sobering, and I think we all need to pause and reflect on this. These are the major challenges, and you watch the other crises, the climate change and biodiversity loss, and the sorts of stresses that we see across communities, the cost of living, leading to an increase in the risk of conflict and then the institutions that may or may not be able to address them. I'm wondering, I'm going to take a side branch of that, and I'm going to ask about intergenerational justice and equity. In Australia, we're currently debating this duty of care legislation around future generations. I wonder if that's a mechanism by which we can think through these complex problems. Does it help us to get that lens of imagining future generations or seeing past generations? And Helen, I will start with you again.
If you go back to the definition of sustainable development that came out of the Brundtland Report, it was very much about meeting the needs of the present generation without compromising the future generations. And we've kind of lost that a bit, haven't we? So I think in this discussion around the Summit of the Future and the Pact for the Future, this future generations theme is actually an extremely important one, and how to get, you know, meaningful youth engagement in all processes. I mean, UNICEF's long been a great champion of the voices of children into the international arena and national arena and debate. UN Population Fund also picking it up at the, you know, adolescent, young adult level and so on. But, you know, ask ourselves in our societies, do we provide enough space for young people to have meaningful input in decision-making in its various forms, or do we leave them marginalised to shout from the edges and, you know, largely turn a deaf ear until it you know, gets too noisy to ignore. So I think all these debates are going on around the international system at the moment. And, you know, maybe, you know, labelling it a quest for intergenerational justice is the way to frame it.
So I would say yes. And I suppose I'm always nervous when I sort of see or hear the responsibility for making the change happen on the people who are experiencing it. And that's different to having a true meaningful voice in the decision-making processes that affect our lives. And I find it remarkable the various sort of places that I've been where the younger person is just, it's so tokenistic of how it's done. You know, like, everybody has something to say. Wouldn't it be marvellous if some of the old white men would just stop it, walk away from the table, and let that table be reconstructed by others? But yet it's still considered that they have to invite them in. I find it remarkable. It makes me so angry. But the instrument of the duty of care has real potential. I think that there would be a legally binding instrument that holds to account. That's different to the principle of how it's done.
Beena, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
Thank you, Arnagrata. I will draw from humanitarian sector, which is so different because you're thinking about intergenerational trauma in such a different way. And we just do not have, not only we do not have enough programs and operations that address them beyond actually psychosocial kind of programs and operations, we just don't even have enough words to capture what's happening everywhere around the world. Simply having even images of dead children, they don't matter anymore. We see it from current conflicts, what's happening around us. But in terms of that, children and young people, they carry with them so much trauma. They do not carry only with the trauma. I mean, if we're only talking about people on the move, they are actually not carrying the trauma only of that time or when they're being forced to move. They carry their past, and they're also thinking of future in that way, and they carry the trauma of the dead people around them, the missing around them. We do not talk about the dead enough when we are talking about life. And so some of those actually are not enough, we don't have enough vocabulary to talk about. The humanitarian vocabulary is missing there, but also thinking about that in the language of justice, what it means when they come into a safe environment. And it would depend depend in terms of context. For example, in Sierra Leone, we have seen, in DRC, we have seen the context is very much focusing on repairing harm, thinking about do no harm and best interest principle in one particular way with young people. In South America, we have seen thinking about past injustices. So we have different kinds of examples globally coming from. They're even actually informing us that it's not only intergenerational, but it's also context specific. But the work actually has to continue for a long, long time. It's like almost as if we're moving a slow tanker. We wouldn't see the change immediately, but we have to work. And all of you talked about hope, and I think that's where some of the messages need to come and tie to the language and actions of justice. Thank you.
I wanted to come back to Sharon Friel's table. Who's at the table? Who's helping to guide this decision making? And Helen, have the people at the table changed a lot in your time in politics?
Well, actually, yes. You know, when I entered the New Zealand Parliament at the age of 31 in 1981, the numbers of women doubled from 4 to 8 out of 92. We were under 9%. And in the last parliament in New Zealand, the numbers of women reached the 50% mark. So that was, you know, a huge change. Also, the parliament became more diverse in other ways. People who are proudly LGBTQI, very significant Maori representation, significant Pacifica participation, members of parliament coming from the diverse other ethnic communities in New Zealand as well, the migrant communities. So I saw a lot of change. I also saw more young people coming in and not necessarily seeing coming into politics as something that they're going to do for the rest of their life, but they're coming in now to make a contribution. And the current leader of the co-leader of the Green Party in New Zealand, I think, is an example of that. She's a young woman. She's impatient. She's going to make her mark. Would she be there in 15 years? I doubt it. But, you know, she's coming to, you know, give it a best shot now. So I think there is a lot more diversity in sort of small, open democracies like New Zealand. But that won't be everyone's experience. I always recall the wise words of a very senior humanitarian worker at a UN round table I had in Mali on a visit when they were really in deep trouble, as they are now. And I remember this worker saying to me, Helen, it's important to acknowledge that young people here have a lot of negative options and not many positive ones. I said, tell me more. And she said, well, she said, you can toil over a dusty plot when the rain may never come, or you can probably earn $100 a month, which is more than you'd earn in a year off your plot, by teaming up with people who are trafficking people, contraband, arms, terrorist group. And the other alternative, she says, is, you know, you sort of hitchhike and make your way through to the assembly points to make the dangerous journey up through the desert to the Mediterranean, where you may or may not be able to cross. She said, so that's what it looks like to a lot of young people. And whenever I look at those photos of the boats sort of coming into a port in Malta or Italy or a boat sinking in the Mediterranean, what do you see on those boats? You see so many young, hopeful faces wanting something, you know, that can improve their lives, and often ends in tragedy. So, you know, out there, I feel there's just such yawning gaps and injustices which we should be making it our mission to address. You know, in these times of crisis, we often forget these daily development challenges which face people in low-income countries. We're overwhelmed by the humanitarian tide, but there's this slow-burning crisis of a youth demographic coming through which does not have a lot of positive opportunities in many societies.
Bina, did you want to... Give
yes, thank you, Arnagrada. Yeah. I was actually nodding to what Helen was mentioning, because I served in the front line in Lampedusa and Italy. It was absolutely horrendous when we were receiving children on their own, making desperate journeys. And then working, then there was one kind of, we saw so many of them just expecting that that they would experience violence on the way. So previous kind of civil society awareness campaigns in sending countries or those communities that these pathways are dangerous, they could create different kinds of vulnerabilities. Those kinds of old campaigns are no longer working because people are so desperate. They are willing to sacrifice one child to save the rest of the family. So we need to think about different kinds of way how we respond to some of these issues. In Somalia, in Sudan, people travel multiple times, 7-8 times. It's not one time they are going. If they fail, they take another route. So thinking about vulnerabilities in different ways and actually responding to those from a different direction is very important. And I think Helen mentioned before about empathy, and that's key. Just 4 days ago, EU signed a new deal with Egypt of $7.4 billion, thinking about to manage migration. We can't manage migration by funding frontline states. It's not working. We know from Turkey, we know from other countries, we can't manage migration by building walls. So thinking about it different ways, I think, it would require empathy, it would require compassion, it would require leadership, really bringing some radical ideas. Thank you.
So radical change and new ways of doing, new ways of thinking, new ways of learning. I've got one last question for the panel, and then we're going to invite some questions for the audience. So if you've got a question, please get that ready. I'm thinking about new ways of doing and being, and I'm going to reflect on Genevieve Bell's comments earlier and the history of the Australian National University and that observation that Nugget Coombs made all those years ago, that universities can be the powerhouse of social reconstruction. May actually be a really important thing for us as an institution to reflect on today, particularly given the sobering nature of the discussion so far. So I'm wondering about what the role of the university is in addressing the contemporary challenges that we face and on creating our most healthy, our most wonderful, our most inspirational human future. Where do you see the universities in this? I'll start with Bina.
Where is the role of universities? Universities have, I started about radical ideas, maybe I'll give an example from there. So universities are spaces where we can articulate, we learn also how to articulate very complex ideas and also talk to and learn from different kinds of actors. And I think universities have to be at the forefront of these very complex emergencies that we are talking about. We are talking about spaces of such serious human rights violation and famine. We can no longer afford not to actually discuss those. So there's an ethical obligation there as well that we offer those tools and guidance to students. There's an ethical obligation sometimes to speak up, and this is not always easy. And here I can give example from our university in 2017 when we were talking about the Rohingya community and the plight of the Rohingya, whether or not that is genocide or not. We were discussing that in 2017. We should have had that discussion before. So I think where is university and with our kind of very strong leadership there, how we articulate and frame. So this is maybe where I will leave this response. And one thing here important for universities to think about is that our students are very, very keen to understand multidisciplinary lens, how they can resolve, how they can understand about these complex questions. So offering those tools to them. Thank you.
the complex interdependent issues, I think, of our time. And I was also delighted to see that we here at the Australian National University gave you an honorary doctorate back in 2019, Helen. I'm so glad that we did that. What is your thoughts on the role of the university? You've got ties with a number of different institutions around the world. Can we help? How do we help? Yeah, how do we help the most?
Absolutely, and building on all that Bina's just said, firstly, it's a space for the free flow of ideas, which is so critical. Secondly, I think the universities, I've been a university lecturer in my time, we do tend to be in our subject silos, but building those cross-disciplinary spaces is incredibly important. You know, I've seen Australian universities lead on planetary health, for example, bringing a lot of different disciplines together, very, very, very critical. I think using the Sustainable Development Goal framing for that can be one way into it. I was with Professor Michael Marmot, the Marmot Schools and Health Equity and so on, at the Karolinska Institute in recent years, where the rector there said the demand from the students was to hear about more than their medical training. They wanted to know about society. They wanted to know about climate. They felt this was going to be incredibly relevant to their futures, and he used the sustainable development framing to open up that broader space for them. As I said, the research role of the university, producing evidence that is relevant for policymakers, may not be the main function of the research, but there will be applications of it that can be applied to policy. And then let's not overlook one of the most important functions, and it is the teaching of the next generation. It's inspiring young people to believe that, you know, armed with knowledge and skill, you can go out there and make your mark and make a difference for the world. And I think also communicating that it's not just about the individual and what the degree does for you. What can you do for society and the world with the skills and knowledge that you have?
Absolutely. Sharon Bessel. Sorry, Sharon Friel. Apologies. I've done that before, once or twice.
It's a lovely compliment. I was just reflecting on our panel. So this is a panel convened by the College of Health and Medicine, involving colleagues from the College of Asia and the Pacific. Fantastic. So a beautiful illustration of that interdisciplinary sciences meets social sciences and everything in between. So that's more of this type of activity. I was also just reflecting, so at the moment, and I'm just reflecting here in Australia, we've had a big discussion about the consultancy firms going on at with the public service, and the big four have been sort of named and shamed, and just trying to work out how to manage all of that, and the hollowing out that has happened alongside that of the Australian public service, not just because of that, but partly because of that. And so for us as academics, as researchers, why are we not the go-to from the Australian Public Service rather than going to KPMG? That's not to say that I want us to become a consultancy firm by any means, because I think the importance of those radical ideas, and it's not just the political party line that we as researchers toe, we've got to be pushing the policy discourse. But it's a combination of both, isn't it? So I would love us to be the go-to, but that we develop that relationship with colleagues in government where we can have those really exciting radical ideas discussions. Because certainly my time historically, colleagues have loved that. And it might not be right politically there and then, but the window opens up. And all of a sudden, you've got these range of sort of policy solutions to offer in. You know, the drawer gets opened and that gets used. But it means for us as, I'm talking particularly as researchers, we have to be very engaged in that way, and not about the pet projects. Another opportunity for us right now is the National Health and Climate Strategy, where the discussion is still in the healthcare system, but with a real window of opportunity to have that discussion moved and what those solutions would look like that are really cutting across sectors. And that's our role, is to be pushing that agenda, which we've been doing very hard, and then offering those suggestions in a helpful way.
Adding to Sharon's point that also it's important to emphasize that one generation's radical idea through education could become something that we are used to in the next generation. Think about women. Like, it's incredible that four of us are here talking about these issues. Think about women in science, for example. So think about that we have to talk about indigenous people and their right and recognition when we are opening an event. So important these are. So I think this is how we need to embed the idea of what we think of radical today, that future generation think of it. No, it's normal.
I've been thinking about the common space. I've been thinking about polarization and the challenges that we face and the ways in which we're really struggling to have conversations across different borders and different barriers, across different issues and challenges. And it's that common space. It's the non-political space, but the space in which debate can take place, which is so important, which will help us to contend, I think, with the challenges that we face, and also to find some of those ways forward, the shared visions and values that will define us. Universities are central in that space, and we can play, I think, an extraordinary role. Helen, I think Emily Banks asks an extraordinary question about how we can change corporate governance around the major challenges and what benefit that might have. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think there's a magic triangle around the role of government and regulation and law. Corporate leadership that gets it, that if you want a sustainable future for your company, you better start acting like that's important. And then you need consumer pressure. You know, the consumer's asking those pesky questions. Where was it produced? How was it sourced? Was there child labour? Was there exploited labour? Was there prison labour? Whatever. And if you get those three things moving in the same direction, you can get some progress. For example, one issue I've been involved with over the years is trying to get deforestation out of supply chains for palm oil and other commodities, whether it's beef production, you know, cocoa, coffee, maize, etc. And you can, if you get a jurisdiction where the government's prepared to regulate, where the big buyers are saying we won't buy any of this product if it's based on, you know, newly deforested land, and then the consumers are demanding to know how do we get this? You know, where did it come from? You start to get some action. So there's a lot of signals, I think, that have got to come together, but governments can't shy away from their responsibility to regulate around these issues.
Yeah, I mean, I think that question of the legal but lethal, as Nick Freudenberg describes it, a whole suite of actions that can be taken. It's a political choice if that wants to be taken. So around transparency and accountability of political donations, for example, around competition policy and law, around corporate taxation can play an important role, around the regulation of science and information, which currently there's nothing that monitors the scientific messages and the astroturfing that happens by these companies. Actually, implementation, so compliance and enforcement of labour standards would go a long way to address all of this. The development of international legally binding treaties would be really helpful. And then some of the local levers that we have through policy, through, for example, land use planning that doesn't allow the placement of... So there are so many things that can be done to address corporate practices, but there's a choice made not to do it. And it's not just one thing that can be done.
So I'm going to take the moderator's prerogative for a brief moment of reflection. which is simply to tie us back to that moment where I felt hope, the moment where we were given permission to engage in the discussion and the debate, where we can be part of the solution. And I often think of Sharon Friel and the way in which she describes the fact that these things are choices. It's not set in stone that the fossil fuel industry continues to exploit the planet and that we continue to log old growth forests. These are choices that we make. We can be part of the solution. And on our podcast from Crawford School, Sharon Bessel and I regularly talk about the value of caring. Caring for people, caring for place. That might be our choice for our best human future.
This podcast is produced by the ANU's Crawford School of Public Policy. Our thanks to the College of Health and Medicine for their collaboration on this episode. Our thanks, as always, to Hannah Scott for production. So from me, Sharon Bessel, it's bye-bye for now, and we look forward to joining you again next week.